Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Welcome to Vox Novus, the new voice. On June 22nd, U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first Native American to serve as a cabinet secretary, announced the federal government will investigate its past oversight of Native American boarding schools and work to, quote, uncover the truth about the loss of human life and the lasting consequences of policies that over the decades forced hundreds of thousands of children from their families and communities. The recent discovery of children's remains buried at the site of what was once Canada's largest Indigenous residential school has magnified interest in the troubling legacy both in Canada and the United States. How may this generational trauma be addressed? Is there room for collective healing and forgiveness? My guest this week on Vox Novus, Randy Kritkowski, shares his personal quest to go beyond the media reports, find the truth, and work toward healing. Randy, author of the book Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors, is a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation, and his book detailed the powerful story of spiritual awakening, reconnection with nature, and rekindling of ancestral wisdom. He joins me this week to discuss the truth of what happened at these Indian residential schools, the continuing trauma of Indigenous peoples, and how all of us may come together to heal these wounds. Please join me in welcoming to Vox Novus, Randy Kritkowski. Good evening, Randy.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me back.
Randy, last year you joined us to share your book, Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors, about finding your heritage with the Potawatomi tribe, including a discussion of Indian residential schools. Before we begin discussing what's recently been reported, please remind our listeners about your path and what you shared in Without Reservation.
Well, as you know or may recall from some of the fragments of the discussion, when I wrote this book a few years ago, I included a chapter that was really a chapter taken from family history, not from broader history. And I discussed my encounter with my grandfather's experience at Indian residential schools. He had spent virtually all of his adolescence and most of his childhood at three of these schools. And he had never talked to us about it. So in the book, I mentioned going to a play in Canada about Indian residential schools. It was called Children of God and performed almost virtually in my lap on a stage, you know, within arm's reach, was a very moving representation of what happened emotionally and psychologically and historically at the Indian residential schools. And for a few minutes, I felt like someone in an airplane about to crash land. And then, as I described in the book, all of a sudden I felt my grandfather's presence, you know, in the room. And I realized that he was participating in telling us the story of part of our family history that he had never told us. Even though he had spent so much of his life in these schools, he could never in his lifetime talk about the experience. As I say in the book, he could talk about his experience in World War I in the trenches with mustard gas and other horrors of war, but he couldn't talk about residential schools. And there it all spilled out on the stage. And at first I was outraged. I was furious. I was on the verge of tears. And then suddenly I felt this feeling of, he's here. He's saying, Randy, this is what I couldn't tell you. Now you can know.
And just to remind our listeners, tell them of your heritage through your mother.
So my mother was an enrolled Potawatomi tribal member through my grandfather. Our tribal lineage is traced, unlike some other tribes, not by blood quantum or blood percentage, but by simply having been enrolled in the tribe as of a certain date. And it turns out that my grandfather's grandfather, my great-great-great-grandfather, was the first person to enroll in the citizen Potawatomi Nation when it took the deal that the federal government operated, the deal being that we would give up our common lands and accept individual parcels in exchange for citizenship. It was part of trying to break the back of Native American communal life, which has everything to do with why residential schools were created.
And just remind our listeners where the land of the Potawatomi was.
Originally, it was in Chicago. Chicago is the Potawatomi word for wild onions. We were removed from this area forcibly in the 1830s and literally marched at Soldier Point with many deaths resulting to Kansas. And then from Kansas, where we were removed again within a generation to the desert of Oklahoma. So we experienced climate change in two generations on a level that the world is only beginning to imagine it might collectively have to encounter.
As I had mentioned in the introduction to this interview, the story of the horrible atrocities that took place and the bodies that were found broke a few months ago. Let's start with the obvious question. What is the history of Indian residential schools?
It's actually a little bit murky because the media has made it murky, and some Native Americans have. They were created at the end of the 19th century in order to, the word was, kill the Indian to save the man. Now, that literally doesn't mean genocide, killing the persons. It meant kill the Indian-ness in the remaining Indians by taking away the children and sending them to boarding schools, which had a military design because it was Colonel Pratt who had been the administrator of a prison school, who decided that reschooling works. It can rehabilitate people. So young children were taken to these schools. Their hair was cut. They were given English names. Their Indian names were taken away. And depending on which media story you read, and we'll get back to the reality of this in a moment, the narrative that's dominant right now is that they were prohibited from speaking even a word of their native language at these schools. The reality is more complex, but it is true that brutal disciplinary techniques, beatings, denial of food, were used to get these young kids to comply with the demands of the school.
Was there anyone involved in oversight?
Oh, yes. The U.S. government, various churches, Christian churches, not just the Catholic Church, which you might suspect from reading the media reports. Most major Protestant religions were involved, at least to some degree. In Pennsylvania, even the Quakers were involved in these schools. There were reports done on the schools. They made the headline news in the New York Times at the beginning of the 20th century. The stories that were being told in the New York Times at that time are no different than the ones we're reading now. So this is not a new story for us. It's not a new story for the United States. It's just a new awakening to a story we were tone deaf about for 100 years.
And how is it possible that this went on without someone raising their voice?
Well, people did raise their voice. Certainly Native Americans were raising their voices. As I said, you know, there was a famous physician in Canada who wrote a report similar to reports written in the United States about children dying, about disease being rampant, about malnutrition, mistreatment. But as we know from looking at other genocides across the face of the globe, people in the mainstream, people who are not literally intimately at arm's length from those being victimized, sometimes have a remarkable capability of being blind.
And as you said, this was both in the Canada and in the United States. Is that correct?
Yes. The schools, the word would be inspired one another. The Canadians came and studied what was going on at two of the three residential schools where my grandfather went. The Carlisle Indian School was the one they modeled for the cultural assimilation and educational programs. And the Hampton School, where my grandfather went in Virginia, was a school where they were inspired to adopt a model of vocational training.
So as you shared before, your grandfather withheld this from the family, is that correct?
That is correct.
And did your mother have an inkling of any of this?
We just knew that he went there, and for whatever reasons, maybe the feelings that they got from my grandfather, if the topic would come up, you know how kids are with parents, you know that's not a topic mom and dad want to talk about, so you don't ask. And as I said, you know, I would sit on his lap as a child and he'd talk about the Wild West and seeing corpses of outlaws and, you know, the pharmacy window and the horrors of the trenches. But I never thought of asking him. So, you know, Onondaga, what happened, you know, at the Indian school? Just didn't cross my young mind.
So obviously this has been in the consciousness of the indigenous peoples. What do they think about this history?
Well, that's the really difficult question. First of all, we're going to have to break down the they and realize that what we refer to as Indians or First Nations people in Canada are made up of literally hundreds of separate cultures or nations. So, you know, there is no what they think. Each tribe has its own experience with these schools. Some absolutely horrific, you know, bordering on abuse and violence and death, similar to what we associate with concentration camps. Others had experience, which is, well, you know, the school was, you know, tough disciplinary institution. That was the way it was at the end of the 19th century, but we got a decent education. So there's an enormous, enormous range of experience. I guess we should point out that these schools existed in Canada through the 1990s, not 1890s, 1990s, and here through the 1970s. So we have people who are survivors who went through this experience, and they are out there now reading newspaper accounts about this, and their families are rereading it, and their grandchildren are rereading it. So to answer your question, what are they thinking about, or what are we thinking about, to put it back in the sort of first person personal, is we're trying to come to terms with two things at the same time. One is the revelations about what happened to our parents and grandparents that we all try not to think about too much. And the other is trying to come to terms with the fact that the American public and the media is suddenly saying, oh, look what we discovered. We discovered this new phenomenon. We're saying, oh, actually, we've been trying to tell you this for 100 years. So this raises the really, really fraught question of what we call intergenerational trauma, where, you know, the experience, literally the direct experience of the stress, is passed down from generation to generation. And normally that's done in first person stories. It wasn't in my case. But in other cases, it's passed down physiologically. For example, we know that trees that are born in a drought will produce seedlings that are stressed and ready to deal with drought. We know from children who grow up in warfare-torn countries like parts of the Middle East right now, they are born literally stressed and ready to hit the pavement, ducking bombs and getting out of falling down buildings. So the answer to the question is that each of us responds as we have been culturally programmed, as we have been instructed by our families, and now as we are being re-triggered by the media reports.
Let's talk about those media reports. Are any of them portraying this accurately and with compassion?
I think many of them are trying to do a good job. At first, I wanted to ignore the stories, and then I decided I was going to read every one. I think I'm up to over 200 now. And after you read 30 or 40 of them, you quickly realize something that many of us notice about the media, even you know, the best media sources in the United States, which is they become an echo chamber. They tell stories that obviously they've read from other media reports, and they don't bother to dig much more deeply. So I'll give you one example. We hear, as you referred to, about the unmarked graves that were found at the Canadian schools, Kamloops. It was the most famous at first. Hundreds of unmarked graves were found by ground penetrating radar. What was disturbing is that some media reports started referring to the unmarked graves as mass graves. The wording is a subtle change, but it is a change that conjures notions of the ethnic cleansing in Yugoslavia, where hundreds of people would be killed and thrown into a trench or a concentration camp, where people would be exterminated in a gas chamber and then buried quickly in a mass grave. That does not seem to have happened at Indian residential schools, even though some media reports have used the words. We think what has happened is that kids died of the Spanish flu. It was common then, of tuberculosis, of malnutrition. Probably some were physically abused. There's some suggestion, it is yet to be corroborated, others may have been actually murdered, particularly infants of illegitimate children conceived out of sexual liaisons between the staff and the inmates at the school. So the media reports, they tend to dwell on the most dramatic aspects, because the media has long since learned, as we learn, the media, you know, they never say it, but if it bleeds, it leads. You know, if the story is horrible, you know, more people will click on it. There's been, a default tendency to that. So we get exaggerated claims, such as at no school were children allowed to speak their native language. If that were the case, it would have been simpler for kids to acclimate. But as I know, again, to refer to my own family history and my grandfather's experience at Hampton, the reality was more complicated. At Hampton, the rule was you couldn't speak your native language after breakfast, but you could before. You couldn't speak your native language during the day, but you could after dinner. You could speak it on weekends. And contrary to media reports, children were actually taught the Sioux Lakota language, because they were expected to go home and basically be cultural ministers among the Sioux, and they needed that language to do their work. So the reality is far more complex, far more nuanced, sometimes less horrible than we would be led to believe, other times probably worse.
You use the word murder. Do we know how many?
Well, again, I use the word, as I think I said, you know, there are allegations that illegitimate children of these liaisons that resulted from sexual abuse that was reported then and is reported now by survivors to be rampant, that the newborns were killed. Here's where it gets really dicey. One of the leading forensics experts in Canada said, we have a choice to make. It could take us 30 years to excavate the graves and do the forensics to figure out how each and every individual died. Do we want to spend the next three decades obtaining this information, or do we know enough about what happened that we simply want to repatriate or rematriate the remains, give them a dignified burial back on tribal homelands, and then design a path forward? Or do we want to dwell upon the details of each and every case?
And what has been the response to that?
Well, it's quite a diverse response. I have not read a Native American spokesperson saying, let's move on. I think many Native Americans would be hesitating to say that at this particular moment, because a lot of families do want to know if their aunt, uncle, brother, sister, in some cases, died naturally or violently. They want justice. I can certainly understand that. So we're in the middle of this unraveling story.
And Randy, how have you been processing this information? Are you writing about it?
Yes, I'm in the middle of writing a fact sheet, which I'll post on my website, which deals with some of the issues such as, you know, what was the programming at the schools? Were they successful? We should get back to that in a few minutes, because one of the media misconceptions is that these schools succeeded in wringing the last threads and drops of indigeneity out of us. But to answer your question directly, at first I thought, you know, again, like many Native Americans, I would just weather the storm and get through it. But I found myself having nightmares, night after night, where I would literally be in my grandfather's shoes or feeling what my grandfather felt. And I would wake up in the morning, you know, really just profoundly shaken. I thought I had gotten through it after seeing this play in Canada, but apparently I had not. And as I am beginning to wonder, I'm beginning to wonder if my grandfather's spirit, as we Native Americans say, our ancestral spirits, have not yet completely worked through this themselves.
And you talked about intergenerational trauma. I recently interviewed someone who said that we all carry emotional DNA passed down from our forebears and ancestors. Do you think that's part of it too?
Yes, absolutely. It works in a positive as well as a negative sense. When I am asked about my Indian ancestry and what percentage of Native American I am, people ask that because I look like a Scandinavian. You know, I have the facial structure, the hair color, the blue eyes, you know, and I don't have the dark skin. My response is that we inherit memory. And then I say, think of the monarch butterfly. It, like me, it is five generations removed from its primary ancestor that lived in, let's say, a grove in California in the wintertime, migrates south, and somehow, without GPS, without a map, without a written record, returns to the ancestral grounds from whence its ancestors left five generations ago. We find our ways home. And sometimes finding our ways home is involving pain. Sometimes it involves beauty. And in my particular case, as I outlined in my book, it is awakening to the connections that our ancestors had with nature, which become more and more a part of my life. But it is also awakening to the pain of my ancestors, which is now being reported in the news.
My guest is Randy Kwiatkowski. He's the author of the book, Without Reservation. Randy, please tell our listeners how they can find out more about this work that you do.
Well, I do have a website. It's called randykwiatkowski.com. And I talk a little bit about how and why I wrote my book, and I describe some chapters from the book. And of course, you know, people can read the book and follow my own path of awakening, including the story of my grandfather's experience at the residential schools.
And as you shared, you're going to be putting a summary sheet of the news as you understand it on these events that we're talking about.
Yes, I'm hoping it will be useful to teachers, to journalists, to other Native Americans, people who are in the general public who want to know what happened. And as so many descendants of colonial settlers, you know, are asking me when they call me on the phone now, asking, what can we do to fix things? What can we do to make it right? And not only is this traumatic for Native Americans, it's actually traumatic for a lot of people who have native, non-native ancestry, who have settler ancestry, who are awakening as America has to its history of slavery and saying, oh my gosh, you know, once again, you know, a chapter of our history that we wish we could undo, what can we do to fix it? It's a wonderfully challenging question for people to be asking themselves and to be asking collectively.
And we'll be back with more of Randy after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week is Randy Kratkowski. He's the author of the book Without Reservation. Randy, as we're discussing these past events, in reality, they're as fresh as yesterday, aren't they?
Yes, and I'll explain that in a moment. I'm going to give a very brief sort of preface and warning, which is this gets darker for a moment, but I think we're going to get to light and hope and forgiveness in just a moment. But before we go there, we have to know what Native Americans and all Americans and Canadians are dealing with. So what you're referring to is the news story that's buried beneath the residential school story and in a sense has been displaced by all of the media attention to the past of residential schools. The current story that everyone on reservations knows is that thousands, not hundreds, but thousands of young Indigenous women have vanished in the recent decades in the United States and in Canada. We don't know if they were abducted. We don't know if they were murdered. Very few of the cases of missing Indigenous women have even been investigated. So the othering and abuse of Indigenous people is not something of the past, something buried out in the ground behind the now abandoned residential school. It is part of a history of abusing and objectifying Indigenous people that goes on today. That, I think, is part of the trauma that Native Americans are coping with. This isn't over and done with. This is continuing.
And how will this continue to impact survivors, descendants of survivors, and descendants of white colonial settlers who may be struggling with some sense of guilt?
Well, the Canadians have a wonderful term. They have a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, commission that was created more than a decade ago to try to ask the hard questions, produce a report, which they did. It was a bold and wonderful effort. It was modeled on what happened in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee investigation there. The idea being that we can't move on until we know what actually happened. And we can't move on until there is some kind of justice. And in a moment, I think we'll get to the question of whether justice is mean and nasty revenge and punishment, or whether it involves simply admitting, asking for an apology, some kind of compensation, and then moving forward to healing.
Up to this point, how has the U.S. government been responding?
Well, it tends to be reactive on these kinds of issues instead of proactive. Fortunately, with Deb Haaland, Native American, being the head of the Department of Interior, where the Bureau of Indian Affairs is housed, she's getting out in front and on top of this and basically saying, We're going to be proactive. We're going to explore what happened at these schools. And in a sense, I think the United States is going to begin to not just walk in the direction of the Canadians, but sprint and try to catch up with what they did now, you know, a decade and a half ago. We have a lot of catch-up work to do.
You've been writing about forgiveness as a pathway out of a downward spiral of trauma. How might this work?
Well, I have to say that forgiveness is not something that came to me naturally, spontaneously, from my heart. I probably for much of my life have not been a terribly forgiving person. I could carry a grudge for decades. Some friends of mine who belong to an intentional community of Christians called the Bruderhof, they come from the same origins as the Mennonites who came from Germany, or the Amish. They have settlements up and down the Hudson River. They live collectively. It's one of the more peaceful places on earth I've ever visited. When I got to know them, by mere coincidence, they were working in China with bird watchers and we were, they began to describe some of their projects. And one day in the middle of a conversation, they described work they were doing in Rwanda. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's a long way from here. And they said, yes, we're working on forgiveness. And I thought, oh my gosh, forgiveness in Rwanda. You know, we have this joke about selling refrigerators to the Eskimos. I figured, you know, this is going to be really hard. How do you sell it? And they explained that they took Holocaust survivors, Jewish Holocaust survivors, to Rwanda to explain what it was like to live in the shadows and the memory of genocide for decades. And then some of these people, some of whom were therapists, explained that they came to a moment in their lives when they realized that holding on to the hatred, the bitterness, the desire to revenge really wasn't exacting any punishment on those who perpetrated crimes against them. It was on a daily basis taking its toll on the person holding on to the bitterness. So they wrote a book. The Bruderhof wrote a book. It's going to be listed on my website as a resource. It's called Why Forgive. It's available through Plow, which is their in-house publishing company. It's also free as a download. They're not trying to make money from this. So in the book, they describe one story after another of various individuals, victims of horrific car accidents where most of a family would be killed by a drunk driver, or people who were had family members murdered, or people who were victims of attempted murder. These are all stories about people who came to the conclusion that it was better for them to forgive, not forget, but to forgive than to hold on to the bitterness. And the reason was not a moral imperative to be a good Christian. That's not on every page in this book at all. It's not theological. It's psychological and profoundly human. It's about having the strength to say, I'm moving on. I realized how important this was when I read the quote in the book from Nelson Mandela. As we know, or many of us know, Nelson Mandela was a leader of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and spent 23 years in prison, much of it in solitary confinement. He had every reason to be angry and bitter, but he came out of prison and helped to begin the healing process in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. Nelson Mandela wrote the following: holding on to bitterness is like taking poison to get revenge on your enemy. I had to read that twice. It knocked me over when I first read it. Holding on to bitterness is like taking poison to get revenge on your enemy. He's not preaching. He's not saying thou shalt forgive, thou shalt turn the other cheek. He's saying, if you want to heal yourself, start by letting go of the hatred and the bitterness.
My wonderful teacher, Rabbi Joseph Gelberman, who founded the new seminary, the first interfaith seminary in 1981, would share his experience. He lost his only daughter and his wife in the Holocaust. And here was a man who had every reason to have hatred toward those responsible for this. And he would paraphrase the words of Nelson Mandela and also Malachi McCourt and others, saying he would not hate because hatred is like taking poison and expecting the other person to die. What are the obstacles to embracing forgiveness?
Well, obviously, one of the obstacles is culture. All of us, I think, on the face of the earth, participate in cultures that feel that you must punish perpetrators, and the more severely you punish them, the more just the treatment, and the more our satisfaction for revenge is satisfied. That's part of it. I think there's a fear of being viewed as a weak person if you forgive, because we confuse forgiveness with forgetting, and we confuse forgiveness with not seeking justice. So many of the stories in this book that I alluded to are about people, again, who had family members killed by a drunk driver. They don't go into court and say, hey, you know, let this guy go free. You know, so he killed my family. Big deal. Let's move on. Forget. What they're basically saying is, no, justice requires that this person pay a price. It is part of the, you know, the attempt to discourage others to engage in such behavior. But then what they say is, I'm going to get to know the family of the person who did this to me, because that family is now going to be traumatized. They're going to be deprived of a breadwinner. They're going to be deprived of a loving father or husband or brother. They're going to be most likely, more likely victims of poverty. They're more likely to continue the spiral of events, addictions, social challenges that put this person in the situation where they engaged in horrific behavior in the first place. So once again, we can come to terms with the reality of what's out there, but it requires having the strength to do that. Turning the other cheek, as the Christians like to say it, is not literally turning the other cheek and saying, you know, hit me again, brother. It's basically saying, if you hit me, I'm not going to strike back in mindless anger. I'm going to turn the other cheek. You may hit me again, but I'm going to try to hold on to my reason and my own centeredness, because I don't want to be brought down to your level. That is not a common concept in our culture, and certainly not in Native American or indigenous culture, where being a warrior is a big part of that culture.
That's amazing to me that those people had that sense, not only of forgiveness, but also of embracing the family of the offender. That's the ultimate act of human compassion.
Indeed, it is. And that's where they find the healing begins.
When I grew up in the 1950s, when someone would do something that would be hurtful, my mother used to say, forgive and forget. Forgiveness, I understand. Why not forget?
Well, I mean, if it's the kid who stole your lunch money or, you know, your candy bar on the playground, maybe it's small enough that you can forget. Maybe, you know, mother was right in the sense of, you know, don't hold on to that for too long, son. I don't think your mother would have suggested that we forget about the Holocaust or forget about what happened on Indian reservations. I think, you know, again, we need to have different approaches to different situations. And one of the things I'm working on right now and in my writing is how forgiving and forgetting works on an individual level, as we've been talking about, you know, individual cases, how it works on a collective level for a people, like Holocaust survivors or Native Americans or Armenians. I could go on down the list around the world. But also, ultimately, I think we come to the really challenging question to return to the deeply personal notion of forgiveness is, where do we begin forgiveness? And I've been having dinner with people in street corner conversations about this. And when I start talking about it, what comes out of people's mouths is, oh, I haven't been very good about this. I need to forgive my mother. You know, and it just spills out. And then some people will volunteer, oh, I need to forgive myself. And I won't ask for what. It's obviously some dark secret, maybe a small thing they've carried their entire lives. But people are struggling and coming to terms with the fact that they punish themselves, not only for what others have done, but sometimes they punish themselves for what they have done. St. Augustine famously wrote in his Confessions about feeling guilty his whole life for pears he stole from his native's orchard, or his neighbor's orchard. It's amazing, you know, the little wounds that we carry and can't let go.
And in terms of collective healing, how important do you see it? I would see it this way, that we begin a process of education with our children about all of these things.
I don't think we're going to get to where we need to get on this issue of residential schools without forgiveness. And part of it is, I think people in the mainstream need to forgive their ancestors for what they did to Native Americans. They're not responsible. They didn't do it. You know, it's like telling Germans today, look, your grandfather, you know, was a Nazi. You're not guilty. You know, we don't hand down societal guilt. We hand down societal senses of responsibility for history, but let's try to break the guilt trip. That is another form of punishment that we inflict on ourselves. So I think that if we come to terms with the reality, as we do that at each step, we have to forgive again and again, because as we open our minds and our hearts to understanding what really happened, new wounds appear. As my friends in the Bruderhof keep reminding me, forgiveness is not something you wake up one morning and do, and then everything is placed behind you. Very often, forgiveness is something you do one morning when you wake up, and then for days, weeks, months, years, perhaps the rest of your life, you remind yourself, I have to forgive again today. Otherwise, I'm going to be bitter again today. It's an active process. It's a continual process, but it's an upward spiral instead of a downward spiral.
My guest is Randy Kretkowski. He wrote the book Without Reservation. We'll be back with more of Randy after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Right now, our country feels divided, but there's a place where people with different political views and life experiences are coming together through the power of conversation, and it feels good. Hear more at lovehasnolabels.com/onesmallstep. A message from StoryCorps, Love Has No Labels, and the Ad Council.
Back on Vox Novus, my guest this week, Randy Kretkowski. He's the author of the book, Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. Randy, does forgiveness mean that victims don't seek justice in the form of legal actions or restorative and compensatory action?
No, quite the opposite. I would say, as I alluded to earlier, that forgiveness allows people to have a clearer head and a clearer mind and spirit about what is appropriate and whether we want to seek revenge or whether we want to seek what is known as restorative justice. We have a very strange criminal justice system where we punish the perpetrator, but we don't compensate the victim. Native Americans have a restorative justice system where you put the perpetrator back in the community, and it is their responsibility to work with the community to undo the harm, the physical damage, the economic damage, the psychological damage that they inflicted. Now, this doesn't work with a child abuser, you know, or someone who's engaged, you know, continually in physical violence, but in many cases, it is successful. So there is a way of being more effective by getting a more humane perspective on forgiveness. And it involves justice. It is an essential component of forgiving.
What are the broader lessons of forgiveness for our personal lives, family life, community life, and political scene?
Well, I'm hoping that my Native American kin will not just inspire this generation with their environmental ethic, but that we might use this particular moment of sympathy with our historical plight to teach an equally important lesson about healing our relationship to the planet and one another. And as we have discussed, briefly in other places, I think right now, much of humanity, much of the mainstream is struggling with feeling that they're being punished by Mother Nature for crimes against the earth. You know, we hear people saying things like, you know, we're becoming and it's extinct and we deserve it, or this COVID virus is nature's revenge on what we have done and we deserve it. This is victimizing ourselves. This is embracing, what we think is bitterness that deserves to be heaped upon us. It's the ultimate in perversity. So I'm hoping that Native Americans can help us by modeling their own communal forgiveness, by modeling how we can move forward collectively and say, okay, we've had divisive elections, but don't we have a common future? Don't we have children that we want all to breathe clean air and to have safe schools and have food? Can't we get on the same page by putting it behind us and pressing the restart button? I really think this is the issue for the times. I think climate change and racial justice are manifestations of something larger, which is our inability to be compassionate, healing human beings.
You know, I'm a baby boomer. I was born in the 50s, the early 50s, and we're in the midst of the greatest divisiveness on all levels than I could ever remember in my lifetime. What do you see as the healing path?
I think we, and I am of the same generation, I think we need to come to terms, each of us in these different generations, where the baby boom generation, we have X and millennials, et cetera. I think each of our generations carries its own burden. And in many ways, they're very distinct. As you alluded, ours is the post-World War II affluence generation. We thought, we were on top of the world. We thought that medicine was going to get rid of all disease. We were going to put a man on the moon. We were going to solve all problems through engineering. And then we have this wake up moment, which I describe in my book, of this tiny little mindless virus coming around and defeating our pharmacological industry and our research and teaching us a very humbling lesson. And I think we have to throw humility into the equation that we've been talking about along with forgiveness. Behind me on the table, I have seven stones of the seven grandfather teachings of the Potawatomi tribe. And one of those stones, when I turn them over each day to see which instruction I'm going to be given, is about humility. And that is part of what we're having a really tough time getting our brains around. We're used to getting our own way. And I'm going to speak here as an American. We quote won the Cold War. We won the recovery after World War II. You know, we were the great economy, the great traders on the earth. And all of a sudden, all of it is just wobbling. All of it is uncertain. So I think we need to realize that we are not quite the masters of the universe that we thought we were. And I think this leads us to the conclusion that each of us is part of a collectivity. We are not self-seeking, maximizing homo economicus, the way Adam Smith is misinterpreted as suggesting. We don't benefit, all of us, by pursuing our own greed. As Native Americans have long argued, you know, when you bring an elk back to the village in the winter and everyone is starving, everyone gets a little bit. We all still are hungry, but your family doesn't feast and everyone else starves. So we're at that moment again in history where we have to share. I mean, it's the lesson we learned supposedly in kindergarten. We need to forgive and we need to be humble about our ability to endure individually without taking into account our neighbors.
And what about gratitude?
That's one of the other virtues of Native American culture. When we take something, whether it's picking strawberries or tomatoes now in the garden, we do it with incredible self-consciousness of this is a gift. It's not an undeserving gift. It is just a gift freely given by Mother Earth. And we take what we need. So if we're picking blueberries, wild blueberries in the mountains here in Vermont right now, we don't pick them all. We leave some for the bear. We leave some for the birds. We leave some for our other kin. That is our way of thanking Mother Earth for what she does for all of us, not by grabbing it and saying, thank you, Mother Earth, I got mine. I dug up the mountain and took the coal away, and now I've got my 27, you know, summer homes. It goes back to, you know, humility and sharing and compassion, as you have pointed out several times in this program. It all goes back to compassion. It's not easy to maintain that attitude. It is a struggle.
We have a conscious audience, people who are spiritual, people who are caring, people who are compassionate and loving. What would you say to them that they can do to start affecting this healing process?
I think each of us, each day when we get up, we need to ask what it is that we do and can do that promotes our own healing. That's an okay place to start. That's not egocentric. And from that, I think our own self-exploration will lead us to understanding that what we have to do for ourselves, for our own self-healing, is what we need to do for our friends, our family, our community, and the world. And we need to take lessons from nature, lessons about healing, lessons about forgiveness. As I said, Mother Earth is not punishing us. We punish Mother Nature. And how does she respond? With gifts. That's the way we need to respond.
And how may they convey this message to their children?
I think we need to tell our children and ourselves stories about ourselves that we would want to hear, and stories that point to an upward spiral instead of a downward spiral. I have taken, as many of my family and colleagues have, to reading a lot less of the news lately. I'm not an ostrich. I know what's going on around the world, but I don't allow myself to have the TV blaring constantly about, you know, the latest crisis and the latest insult and the latest car accident. I am determined to tell myself stories each day that inspire me, give me hope, and remind me of the very values we've been talking about today, you know, forgiveness, gratitude, humility. Those are the stories worth telling our children. But in telling our children, we educate ourselves. That's the beauty of reading a child a story. It's not just telling the child. It's reminding us of the dreams and aspirations we had as little children that we may have forgotten.
And how about engaging them in stewardship of this world?
Again, we do it by modeling, and it doesn't have to be the grand gesture. It isn't about donating a huge amount of money, you know, to some environmental cause. It's about doing the little things constantly. When we pick the berry, taking a moment, as Native Americans would very often, to lay down a little tobacco as an expression of gratitude, not because laying down tobacco is magical, but because it makes us hesitate and be mindful of the gift that we're receiving. Those kinds of momentary breaks in our busy lives make us reflective. And that's what's absent from too much of modern life.
Mindfulness, the key to everything. My guest, Randy Kratkowski, his book is called Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. Randy, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Please visit my website, randykratkowski.com, and drop me a line. Let me know what you're thinking, how you're reacting. I'd love to hear from listeners.
And spell your name for our listeners, please.
Sure. First name is R-A-N-D-Y. Last name, K-R-I-T-K-A-U-S-K-Y.
Randy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this important message and this important information. And I hope that the work that you're doing in terms of the summary of the truth that's being revealed will start to be an effective healing.
Miigwech for this invitation. Miigwech is thank you in Potawatomi.
And thank you for joining us on Vox Novus. I'm Victor, the voice, Furman. Have a wonderful week.